Hello, my name's Peter Krekelin. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome you and thank you for joining us for our third case in a three-part CMEO briefcase series entitled Informed Treatment Decisions for Pain Management, Changing Habits and Improving Outcomes. We hope that you'll join us for the entire series of cases. As we know, case-based learning is a great way to illustrate not only the challenging patients you may see, but also a great way to share experiences and strategies for overcoming those challenges of those patients that we see on a daily basis. Today's CMEO briefcase is entitled, Keeping Patients Safe, Education About Safe Disposal of Opioids to Prevent Diversion. I'm Peter Krekelin, and I'm an adjunct assistant professor of pharmacology at St. Francis University in Loretto, Pennsylvania. There I teach pharmacology to the physician assistant class, that fifth year didactic class. And I also work as a pharmacy manager at Thompson Pharmacy in Altoona, Pennsylvania, a small little community pharmacy. I'm joined today by Vincent Capone. Vince is an associate medical director and physician assistant at the Empower 3 Center for Health. He's also a trauma physician assistant at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, where he does trauma and emergency medicine here in Altoona. Welcome, Vince.
Thanks, Pete.
Well, let's get started. We'll start with an overview of our goal for today's activity. Our learning objective is to educate patients about safe storage in the home and disposal of unused opioids to prevent misuse and diversion. So let's take a look at our first patient. We'll call her Helen. Helen's a 79-year-old Hispanic female who recently had a hip replacement. Her hip replacement went well. It was uncomplicated. And following the surgery, she was transferred to a rehab center, and she did very, very well there. She did her physical therapy, she did her occupational therapy, and after her surgery, she was on oxycodone acetaminophen 5-325 with a dose of one tablet every 4 hours when needed for severe pain. So following that week of intensive rehab, and she did so well there, she was only taking oxycodone acetaminophen 5-325 just at bedtime. And the rest of the time during the day, she'd be taking acetaminophen, and that was managing her hip pain rather well. So after 2 weeks in that rehab facility, Helen was discharged and she got to come home. How happy she must have been after 2 weeks to get to be in her own house, in her own surroundings. And she's supported there by her daughter that lives nearby. Upon discharge, when she was getting all of her stuff together, packing her suitcase, they gave her her pack of unused opioids to take home. She was told by the facility nurse that she had to take them with them. She didn't want them. She didn't feel they were necessary, but she said Medicare paid for them. Medicare requires you to take them home with you. So now she's at the pharmacy and she's concerned about having them in her home and asking, if I will take them and if I will dispose of them. Well, Vince, you probably don't need to convince anyone in the audience about the power of education, but can you be a little bit more specific about what kind of education and why it is so important?
Sure. I think foremost that any education we're providing a patient be as specific to that patient's particular circumstances as possible, and that it's a conversation with a patient rather than kind of at them. Because in this case, there are a lot of dynamics to unpack. Right, her age, she lives alone, so there are some kind of specific educational things that you would want to speak with Helen about, and when possible, I think another specific education point is to connect those educational subjects to outcomes for that patient. How is it going to affect their functioning? How is it going to affect their ADL, their activities of daily living, to make it specific and real for that person? The general things, you know, about pain medication should definitely be discussed, but to tie them into Helen as a person with sort of unique factors is very important.
Exactly. And I think so often we just get comfortable with a patient like that talking about constipation, saying, you know, of course, constipation is the one side effect that they never become resistant to. Those is where most opioid discussions seem to end. You know, as long as they're not constipated and they're not extremely drowsy or trying to drive a car, we think we've done a good job. But we really need to stretch beyond those commonly discussed points about opioid education. So let's ask the audience what type of education they think Helen would benefit from. Well, obviously, Vince, there's a lot that we can talk to Helen about. Of course, we want to make sure that she understands the fact that this pain could get a little bit worse now that she might be doing stairs, now that she might be walking around, now that she's not monitored so closely. You know, when she gets to be in her own home, she might become a little bit more of a daredevil. She might decide to go up and down those basement steps, or if she's on a two-story house, might be a little bit more of a challenge for her to get to the bedroom. What are some challenges you see about discharging a patient from a long-term care facility back to their home?
Just as you said, in the rehab facility, while they address these things, it's still different when the patient's back at home, and you have to consider things like how many stairs is she able to conduct all her ADLs from one floor if there's multiple floors. Can she get to the kitchen? Can she get to the bathroom? Can she get to her bed? You know, to address things like lighting, to discuss that her pain may fluctuate now that she is moving around more, and to have an avenue for her to discuss that, yeah, my pain is worse, and that that she doesn't need to either just kind of suck it up, so to speak, right? That she can let her provider know, and options can be discussed.
I think for those first couple days, we probably shouldn't be too aggressive in destroying those pain medications she might want to bring back to the pharmacy.
Exactly. And in her case in particular, I think fall risk is a major factor, not just with opioids, but many medications. There are several validated tools that will score a patient's fall risk. Often those are in the protocols of an inpatient facility in a rehab, but not sometimes paid as close attention to in the outpatient setting. So to discuss all those kind of physical barriers in the house, but also how medications can affect that increased risk for fall. Unfortunately, it's not uncommon that a fall in someone of her age can be a major medical concern, a fractured hip. It's not uncommon for someone of this age to be on anticoagulants, even if it's just aspirin. So a fall and bump on the head can turn into a big deal medically. So I think to explain to her thoroughly all of those factors, and kind of wrap it up in about maximizing her safety as she continues to recuperate from this major surgery.
Absolutely. And I think what we need to do in her home is make a lot of adaptations. Does she have adequate lighting in her home? Does she have night lights in all of her bathrooms so she can see where she's going? What about how many of our older ladies just love to have throw rugs in the kitchen? Get those throw rugs out of there. Watch for extension cords. You know, and you hit the nail on the head, Vince, when you said, you know, she already has a broken hip. She probably does have at least osteopenia, if not osteoporosis. So we need to talk to the family and make sure that there's grab bars installed in the tub. Does she have a shower chair? Does she have bars and railings around her toilet? So not only do we want to make sure that she recovers well and has all the tools in her house, we need to prevent any future falls. You know, we remember our beers list. What's all the drugs on the beers list? Pretty much those that can potentially cause a fall, because nothing will cause more problems medically for a patient than when they fall. So, you know, Vince, as a pharmacist, I come out a lot from behind my counter and I talk to patients a lot. So what do I do when they come into my pharmacy with that big blister pack full of Percocet? Let's say it's 2 weeks after she's home, she's stable, she's not using her pain medications, hasn't had any. So how do I get rid of them? What am I going to talk to my patients about when I see these opioids coming into the pharmacy? Well, the first thing we have to do is make sure we see safe storage of those opioids. A lot of times, I'd say probably 80% of all teenagers, when they start abusing opioids, they find them in medicine cabinets, and going to visit grandma might be a reason to make sure that they're locked up. Lead them not into temptation. So taking those medications and not having them in a medicine cabinet, putting them in a safe spot, maybe even a lockbox if necessary. As far as naloxone goes, I'm a fan of naloxone. Anytime my patients are taking more than 50 morphine milligram equivalents, and there's lots of online calculators to help you determine that, or if they're taking a concurrent benzodiazepine, those patients should be prescribed naloxone. The Center for Disease Control tells us that. So I am a big guy in using naloxone. In the state of Pennsylvania, our Commonwealth physician and head of the health department, Dr. Rachel Levine, has standing orders. I don't even need to call a physician. All I need to do is just fill the prescription, and I use Dr. Rachel Levine's billing codes. I've probably dispensed over 120 to 150 doses of naloxone over the past couple of years since Dr. Levine's standing orders. I also am going to always be recommending, if it's appropriate, NSAIDs as well as acetaminophen. And again, our ESPERT screening can be very valuable if we find that the patient is taking more and more of those medications. So Vince, Helen was not overreacting to the risk of having unused opioids in her home. Are there any data to support the risk of having that stuff in the house?
There is, and I think, patients like Helen are in a particularly vulnerable group when it comes to how those meds are stored. The question about diversion that comes to mind is these medicines that are being diverted are coming from somewhere, right? And it's not uncommon that it's grandma's medical or medicine cabinet. So as the slide indicates, that you know there is some data that kind of buttresses the increased risk for a patient like Helen.
Absolutely. So what do we want to share with our patients? First thing I want to tell them is, again, lock up your medications, put them someplace. You know, Vince, I could break into most people's houses and probably find their stash of pills. Most of us are going to keep them next to the coffee pot, right? We might see them in the downstairs medicine cabinet. So that's not where patients should be putting their controlled substances. Maybe they should even be considering using lock boxes and having them in a secure location. As far as getting rid of the medications, when you bring it back to a pharmacy, it's considered toxic waste. So we really can't dispose of it unless we have a means and a chain of command to be able to get rid of it. So the DEA does have these collection sites, registered collection sites, where they capture that medication and get rid of it. You can also discard medication in your household trash, but you want to make sure that it becomes unusable. I think many of us are familiar with the world famous kitty litter, using kitty litter and using coffee grounds in a Ziploc bag. Well, there's some other products too that are available. And this is one of them. What you do with this little envelope is you open it up, you tear it open, and dump it into the prescription vial with the medication in. Add a little bit of water, shake it well, and throw it in your trash. That will deactivate it. If you have more pills than that, there's lots of other products. These are Detura bags, and these were actually given to us by the Attorney General from the state of Pennsylvania. We have such an opioid problem here in central Pennsylvania that Josh Shapiro, our Attorney General, actually purchased cases of those bags, gave them to our warehouse for distribution throughout Blair County. So it's important to get these drugs off the street and to get them deactivated. Of course, the FDA also frequently has take back days. They do endorse flushing, but many oppose that due to concerns for aquatic life. But the bottom line is we are excreting more drugs into the water supply as humans than we do by just throwing those medications away.
And I'll tell you that a touch point for disposal of these drugs, obviously the pharmacy is one, but the primary care office is another. It's not uncommon that people will bring unused prescriptions into the office and ask, what do we do? What do I do with this? So we keep some of those products in the office. We also try to keep up-to-date information on things like drug take-back days and disposal locations, particularly with new patients and often new elderly patients. I've had them bring in bags full of medication. Now, they're not always controlled substances, but, I've had one patient bring in multiple bottles of unused narcotic pain medicines, benzodiazepines, methylphenidate, all these, schedule 2 to schedule 4 narcotics. And sometimes in such large amounts that those products, while they're helpful to get rid of small amounts, there needs to be kind of a backup plan on what to do with larger amounts of medications, because it is definitely not uncommon. Common enough that when I have a new patient, I ask them often to bring in all of their medications, even if they're not taking one, to reduce any potential for confusion, right? When they have on their dresser drawer is 40 bottles of medicines and they don't take them all. But when you do that, you need to have a plan in place on how to dispose of those safely for all parties involved.
Exactly. And we do have such a problem here in Blair County, where we both practiced it. Back in around 2008, a bunch of businessmen got together and started this consortium called Operation Artan. And they provided a lot of funding for the district attorney's office to prosecute these people that are diverting opioids, that are bringing in heroin. And they have really taken a bite out of the opioid problem that we have. One of the things that they did do is they funded these drop boxes in all of our police stations. So in our county alone, you can go to either Altoona, Hollidaysburg, Tyrone, where I live, and you can go into the police station and they have these big old mailboxes that are now repainted and repurposed, and they actually are drop-off spots for you to drop off anything, including your opioids. So we are very, very aggressive with Operation Our Town, to the extent that the DEA take-back days, when they do have them, aren't terribly successful, because people like you, Vince, and people like me are so good at referring our patients to the police stations to get rid of their medications that the DEA take-back days aren't such a big deal anymore.
So, Pete, as we've discussed before with patients, communication should definitely be back and forth, right? It's a conversation. So I think when the patient is at the pharmacy, right, and you encounter them, what are some things that they may not be aware of that they can utilize their pharmacist as a resource for?
Well, as you know, we pharmacists are very highly trained, but laser focused on medication management. You hand me an EKG strip, I'll show you what incompetent looks like. But when it comes to being the medication experts, the pharmacists, that's what our training is. So I spend a lot of time educating my patients about their medication, especially pain management. So my advice is always use the same pharmacy. You need to develop that relationship that when you come into the pharmacy, I can say, "Hi, Dan, how are you doing today?" And Dan knows who Pete is. So I think that's a really good first step, is establishing that relationship, a good working relationship with each other. Secondly, you want to always be looking at non-pharmacological pain management. As you know, with this COVID-19 crisis, the dental offices in our state, for the most part, are closed, and a lot of patients are going to the emergency room for medication. Well, they're coming down to the pharmacy with their clindamycin prescription, the antibiotic, along with 7 or 10 Norco tablets. I tell them, before you use that, use ibuprofen 200 to 600 milligrams per dose. It's not even so much the pain as the inflammation you need to get rid of. So I always am encouraging them, especially for acute pain like that, to use non-pharmacological pain medications. Use ice, use ibuprofen, and maybe hold off on the opioids, because there is a lot of benefit with opioids for certain, but there's also a lot of risks and we don't want to move down that track. We also have to make sure we're checking the med list. Look for herbal medications that they're taking. Look for other medications on their med list that could potentially cause some interactions. So thanks, Vince. Again, we always have great discussions, whether we're sitting at the Empower 3 clinic or whether we're sitting here in this type of a classroom. This has been a great discussion. So let's summarize with our SMART goals: specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. And that is, we hope that our audience will take away from this discussion and apply it to their practice. We want them to seize those opportunities to educate their patients and also educate providers and, of course, our community about the safe use of opioids. You and I have done several presentations throughout the community on the opioid crisis, and whether it's the Chamber of Commerce or even our church groups, always use those opportunities to teach the general public. We want to educate our patients about the safe storage and disposal of medications. For us, we're really blessed to have all those drop-off boxes in the police stations, but for everyone else, they can wait for those DEA take-back days or use those products that I demonstrated here for disposal of medications. And we need to partner with patients and the community to be a resource for health and wellness. We have to work together, whether we're pharmacists, whether we're physicians, physician assistants, physical therapists, because we have to present the entire package to our patients to make sure they get the very best outcomes. So thanks, Vince, and thanks to the audience for joining us today for case 3 of our 3-part CMEO briefcase series. We hope you'll check out the other 2 cases that are available at this link below on CME Outfitters. And please check out the Opioid Education Hub, where you'll find a broad range of educational activities and resources for us healthcare professionals and our patients. We hope we've given you something to think about today, and that you'll be able to integrate these strategies for educating patients on safe storage, disposal, and the use, the appropriate use of opioids to become a resource for them and their overall good health and wellness. Thank you.